Good morning, Mother Earth. Thank you for all your abundant gifts. Good morning, Father Sun. Thank you for feeding all living things on Earth. Thank you, Plant Kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, Animal Kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, Great Spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep. This is Caroline Wise King, your host, and I want to thank you for joining us here today. Last week I told you that Louisa Kolker would be my guest this week, and she very graciously postponed her reappearance on the show to July 12th so that Hank Wesselman could join us today. He's a very busy guy and wouldn't have been available again until the end of August. And I felt that I felt some urgency to have him on the show because of the way the situation in the world today and the fact that we are building the foundation for the next 26,000 years, it's very important that we're aware of changes that we need to make this year or begin making this year. And so let me tell you a little bit about him first. You may have read his books. He has many books out there, and they're wonderful. Hank Wesselman has been a shamanic practitioner for 30 years, but he is also a paleoanthropologist with a master's degree in zoology and a doctoral degree in anthropology. And for the past 40 years, he has conducted research with an international group of scientists exploring Eastern Africa's Great Rift Valley in search of answers to human origins. His fieldwork has allowed him to live among indigenous tribal people who have rarely had contact with outsiders and to encounter their traditional shaman. He has written many books, as I said, and his autobiographical trilogy, Spirit Walker, Medicine Maker, and Vision Seeker, has been published in 13 languages. Last year, he co-authored The Winning Awakening of the Spirit World with Sandra Ingerman. And of course, you know Sandra. She's been on the show, and she's a wonderful teacher and author herself. And his most recent book, The Bowl of Light, gives us a very privileged look into the mind of a Hawaiian elder kahuna and his insights into who we are and what we are doing here. So it is my great pleasure to welcome you, Hank Wesselman.
Well, thanks, Carolyn. Aloha to you from the Big Island.
Oh, thank you. You're living in paradise, aren't you?
I am. It's tough, I know, but somebody's got to do it.
I know. I dream of doing it. I just haven't found a way to get over there. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, my wife and I have a small farm holding, and we've been involved in creating sustainable food production over the last 6 years. And the goal is to have the entire acre involved in producing food, and we're well on our way to achieving that goal. This is part of what I see as the reason, you know, that we're here is to become stewards, good stewards of the earth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we're doing our part.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that, because there is some concerns with the fact that I believe Dow Chemical and Monsanto are all, I know they're on Kauai and Maui, testing GMO and also trying to work with taro and a lot of the indigenous plants there to make them GMO plants or seeds. And so do you have that happening on the Big Island as well?
Oh yeah, they're trying. You know, these technological giants, you know, they're reflections of what Halemakua, the Kahuna Nui, used to call Western mind. And he was quite honest. He said, you know, Western mind and colonial mind is the same. You know, I used to ask him, you know, why is this going on in the world? And he'd just look at me and say, colonial mind. You see, the foundation stone from his perspective for colonial mind, which is the same as Western mind, the foundation stone is dominion. See, our Judeo-Christian God gave us dominion over. It didn't give us responsibility or stewardship. It gave us dominion. And this idea extends itself into Western mind. I mean, it dominates everything we do. By
Yes,
contrast, the foundation stone for indigenous mind is respect, which is a very, very different approach to life and to living in our lifeway systems here on Earth.
Yes, absolutely. You know, actually, the Native American belief system differs. Well, they have a very similar creation story, but it differs in that they say that man was created last because the Great Spirit said that he was the weakest of all his creations, that he would not be able to survive without the plants and animals. So they were created first.
Well,
And
this is
they were
interesting.
told, yes, they were told that man was coming and he was weak and they would need to help him. And so they were told that, you know, you might have to sacrifice your life or, you know, whatever, but you're here to be of help to this new creation that's coming because he cannot survive without you. And
Yes,
so
Halemakua used to say this as well. He used to say, you know, we've all come to be of service. And it's about determining and realizing what our piece of the action is. This was something which I laid out with Makua in that chapter called The Ancestral Ground Plan, which you may have had a look at it. Have you had a look at this book?
Yes, I just finished reading it. It's wonderful. And I do want to go deeply into that, but before we get there, I'm
Sure.
always interested in how people get on the shamanic path because, you know, you and I know that the spirits choose us. We don't, often the person that ends up on the shamanic path, that was not their intention. They start out life with a different purpose in mind and everything. And for you, as a well-educated scientist, it must have been very difficult for you to empty your cup of man's knowledge and mentally shift gears to allow your cup to be filled with the wisdom of the Great Spirit and the ancestors. So, would you tell us a little bit about how the spirits led you onto the path of shamanism?
Well, of course, it started when I was a child, but I didn't understand it then. I had great connection with and reverence for nature, even from my earliest days. And I had my first spiritual experiences, believe it or not, in Central Park in New York, with the fairy folk and the power animals and so forth. I had no idea what they were. But, you know, my response to my life was to go into science. And I've worked in science ever since, oh, 1964, when I started to teach in West Africa at a couple of colleges in the life sciences. So, you know, back in 1972, as I recall, I was doing an excavation in southwestern Ethiopia in the lower Omo Valley as part of a big expedition. I was a grad student at Berkeley then, and my major professor was the director of the expedition. And I remember I began to have these classic out-of-the-body experiences at night, and sometimes during the daytime when I was very much awake. And I had no idea what they were. You know, I thought, gee, you know, I'm having these hallucinations. I've been out in the desert now for 3 months. Maybe it's time to go back to Nairobi and have a milkshake, you know. But there was one particular day I was doing an excavation with a couple of African men. One of them was an indigenous native of that region, a Dasnach tribesman named Atiko. And Atiko was a shaman. I knew he was a shaman because people told me he was a shaman, and I had a very unclear perception of what that actually meant in those days. But I think this guy had a very profound effect on me because I remember one particular day I was doing an excavation about 3 million years old, and I was beginning to get this feeling that I was being watched by something. Now, when you're like a quarter mile away from your Land Rover and you're out in the bush with leopards and lions and buffalo and creatures like this, this is a kind of thing to be concerned about. And you
Yes.
start feeling you're being observed by something. And I remember one particular day, it was around noon, it was probably over 110 degrees in the shade. And I was getting up to, finish up what I was doing, and I got this feeling, it just surged in me. So I remember looking around under the brim of my hat, and my attention was drawn towards my left, and I saw something. It was big, and it was about 6 feet off the ground, and it had spots. And the minute I looked directly at it, it's as though whatever it was stepped through a tear in the fabric of the air and then zipped it closed from the other side, leaving a momentary wrinkle that straightened out, and then it was gone. So I'm thinking, my God, what is this? And I looked back at the Africans, and the one called Atago, the shaman, was watching me. And in looking at him, he was giving me this very level look because he realized that I'd seen it. And this is a man who had spirit vision. He could see them. And so I pointed at the air and the place where this thing had been and looked at him and said, Atako, Kwanini, what is that? And he slowly smiled and he pointed directly at that place in the air and said a single word in Swahili. He said, Shetani. I would learn later that Shetani is the Swahili word for spirit. Unfortunately, my Swahili was never what it could have been. And he had a long conversation with the other African who was a Wakanda tribesman named Mothoka from Kenya. And that was the end of it. I mean, this is how it really began for me. And I have the sense that I was being looked over by the guys on the other side of the mirror. But, those of your listeners who've read Spirit Walker will be aware that back in 1983, I was still living in Berkeley. My lady Jill was with child. She was, close to giving birth to our first daughter. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night and she was uncomfortable. All of her ligaments were loosening up in preparation for birth giving. And so I started to massage her long back and hips to try to help her get back to sleep. And inevitably, the magic that touch creates turned into lovemaking. And so we had this joyous marital encounter, after which I felt quite blissful, and I was about to slip back into slumber, and I felt my physical body becoming invaded with a very curious feeling. It's that same feeling you get when you're on a swing with very long ropes, and as you swing down and up into that heady arc, your body surges with this incredible sensation again and again and again. This is what it was like. And as my dissolving consciousness reformed and turned my attention toward this sensation, it suddenly increased as though somebody was turning up a rheostat. And suddenly it's like I blacked out and the room went completely dark. And when my vision came up, I was standing in a forest at night. And the air was warm. I could smell fragrance in the air. And, as my attention was drawn into this forest, I had a traditional encounter with what tribal people would call a spirit. And this wasn't one of these happy guys from Pixar. This was a formidable encounter with a huge, tall, dark shadow being, which was easily 4 or 5 times my height, sort of a head and shoulders, and then all the way down to the ground, no arms, no legs, no feet. And as I turned my attention towards it, I was aware of the fact that these sensations that I was feeling were emanating from this being. And I had this incredible encounter with what shamans call power. I suddenly understood what shamans are talking about when they talk about power and what they talk about when they talk about ecstatic trance. Because these feelings could have been really alarming, because I couldn't move a muscle, I was completely paralyzed. And I could still hear Jill turning the pages of her book next to me in bed. But here I was, in the presence of this immensely powerful being. That's really how it began for me. And, as you know, it's one thing to read about other people's mystical experiences, but when you have the awesome jolt of the real thing yourself, it changes you. And it changed me very greatly. It was really the beginning of my induction into the shaman's world of mystery and magic. And that's where the book Spirit Walker begins, with this incredible encounter. I had another about a week later, and then a real beauty about 6 months later, just to make sure I was paying attention. And then they stopped. Then they stopped, and I couldn't seem to turn it on again. But it was during this time that I encountered this anthropologist named Michael Harner, who was, conducting workshops. And he came to Berkeley, and I took a couple of workshops from him, and I found them interesting, but I didn't get that same overwhelming cataleptic trance experience that I had spontaneously in the presence of what I think of as the guardian of the threshold. But then when I moved to Hawaii in 1985, I had an ongoing series of visions over a 4-year period in which my conscious awareness was drawn into connection with a man who lives in the future. To be precise, he's a man of Hawaiian ancestry who lives somewhere on the western coast of North America, roughly 250 generations after the collapse of Western civilization. Now, to say that I was surprised by these experiences would be an understatement of vast proportions. I was actually stunned, because when I would have these experiences, it was as though I was him, as though my soul was detaching from my Hank Wesselman person and journeying across the grid, the web, and merging with this man who lived in the future. And I would sometimes be merged with him for 18 hours, or 24 hours of his time. But when my conscious awareness would refocus on my body, lying in bed next to my wife, usually, only moments, would have passed in my own time frame. It's something I still don't fully understand. But, the book Spirit Walker eventually was published by Bantam Books in New York, and it records that 4-year train of experiences connecting with this man as he leaves his community, engages in a journey of geographic investigation into the interior of the lost continent of America. He's a scholar like me, and he's interested in what happened to the great American civilization. That's what Spirit Walker is all about. So
Yes,
Spirit
it's a
Walker was about
wonderful
my,
book.
yeah, have you read it?
Oh, yes. Actually, I read it back when it first came out in the 90s. And I have to admit to you, I had trouble reading it at that time because you were so constantly questioning everything. And I understood that it was your left brain scientist mind that was trying to rationalize this experience that you were having. But I have had personal experiences with the spirit world since I was a small child. And so I take it for granted that these are real and these are, And so I had trouble reading it back then because you were constantly trying to prove that it wasn't happening or it wasn't real or whatever. And of course, you couldn't. But anyway, I reread it about a week and a half ago when I decided, well, I got this input that I needed to have you on the show. And so I reread it and thoroughly enjoyed it. Now I want to read the two books that you wrote following that up to see where else it took you. And I would advise everyone to read it. It's a great book, and it reads like a novel, so it's very entertaining. And it's just that, I understand the struggle that you've gone through between being a scientist and being considered relevant in your field if you're having these kind of experiences that are not acceptable in that field, so to speak. It's like Louisa Colker, the lady that was supposed to be on the show today that we moved up to July, but she had a similar challenge. She was born into a medical family. Her father was a psychiatrist. So when she began to see and hear spirits as a child, this was not acceptable. This was frowned upon. They said those are imaginary things. They're not real. Don't talk about them. So our whole system in the Western world has gone to such lengths to disprove the spirit world and our connection with it that I mean, the two of you and people like you have come forward to change that. I think that's been a very large purpose in your life, has been to make people aware that this spirit world is real.
Well, you know, I'm still doing science. I'm still publishing in Science and Nature and writing monograph chapters. I'm still, you know, publishing on the research that I did in Africa most recently with the Ardipithecus sites. But, you know, I still, you know, have these extraordinary experiences, especially in workshops. In teaching workshops, when I'm drumming for a circle, for example, and I've given them a set of coordinates for where we're going and what we're going to experience without telling them what we're going to see, you know, while I'm drumming for them, I'm doing my own journey work as well. You know, I lead this very interesting life, you know, between the scientist and the mystic. And when I'm practicing science, I'm practicing science. When I'm involved in mysticism, I'm involved in mysticism. And I seem to have no problem keeping these two experiences of reality straight in my own mind. You know, as you know, the indigenous people understand that reality presents itself in two forms, a world of things seen and a world of things hidden. And indigenous people don't draw any distinction between them. Western people do. We expect there to be a very clear boundary between what's inside and what's outside, outside being objective, inside being subjective. But indigenous people don't make this distinction. And the shaman has always been the one who can see into the world of things hidden. And, you know, for your listeners and your listeners who are familiar with your work and the work of your people you have in your show, they're all obviously aware of the fact that what really distinguishes shamans from other religious practitioners is their ability to achieve expanded states of awareness in which they re-geography their conscious awareness into the hidden worlds, into the spirit worlds. And of course, the first thing we discover when we go in there is that that world is inhabited. So the shaman is the one who really uses their own body and their own mind to create the bridge between the world of things seen and the world of things hidden, between the personal world of form and the transpersonal world of spirit. And when that bridge is formed, this is what allows the miracles to happen, because it allows the transpersonal forces to flow across that bridge into our world to manifest effects, which can be very subtle on the one hand, or they can be very dramatic on the other. I'm thinking primarily of the healing that takes place in the workshops that I do, sometimes with my wife, sometimes on my own, in which we have healing rituals, usually as part of every workshop, and we watch, absolutely intrigued, as people move into and discover their own connections with wisdom and power on the one hand. And then we all participate in this healing ritual in which we work on somebody, usually with something serious, like cancer or lupus or HIV or Crohn's disease. And we watch absolutely astonished as these people recover from these life-threatening illnesses. You know, this is not something that I can talk about in a
I
reassuring
know.
way for my academic colleagues, because they're not prepared with equanimity to accept such miraculous things as happening. But, you know, we
Oh,
reach
of
a
course.
certain age where we really can't worry about our academic colleagues' comfort level anymore. And I reached that point about 30 years ago. But, you know, I'm sure they
Yay.
have very mixed feelings about me.
Yeah. I understand because of course doing shamanic work, we see miracles all the time. That miracles are not rare. It's something that happens and on a regular basis. But we can't really talk about it a lot because we are not licensed doctors. We are spiritual healers, and we cannot run into a situation where we would be accused of practicing medicine without a license. And so,
Right.
you know, of course, we always advise people to continue seeing their doctors, which is great because then they come back and say, wow, you know, my lungs were full of cancer and now the x-rays are clear. And I'm like, that's wonderful. Now you know for sure. So we do like them to keep getting checked and have the proof, but we don't talk about it a lot because, you know, it's not acceptable in a large part of our society right now. So tell me something. Have you ever, getting back to your trilogy of going into the future and all, of course, during those journeys into the future, you did not do that with intention like a traditional journey. You were pulled in by that man in the future somehow. But have you ever done a traditional journey to perhaps a time not quite so distant to see what may have happened to cause the
Oh, yes.
fall of the civilization?
Oh, yes. We do this in workshops with groups, especially with more
Ah.
advanced groups. We'll pick a spot like 200 years in the future, and we'll all journey together in a spirit canoe. And we'll all come back from the journey and then report in on what we've been able to perceive. And, it's interesting. Very few people ever come back with perception of big cities or big communities anymore. They all seem very rural, local sort of villages or communities,
Yes.
which center around agricultural and animal husbandry and things like this, in which people are living a much more traditional lifestyle once again. So, major mainstream thinkers like Noam Chomsky, for example, who publishes very interesting essays on the direction that we're headed in. There are many of us, like yourself and myself, who are very, very concerned at the direction that the world is going in, because we realize that unless we change direction, we're likely to end up where we're headed. And
Yes,
we're sort
the
of
endangered
walking.
species as humans.
Well, we are the endangered species. And my first book, Spirit Walker, was about my initiation crisis. And it was really a crisis because, I was not psychologically prepared for it. I was not one of those worthies who'd sat at the knees of the wisdom masters for decades hoping for transcendent experiences. I was a scientist practicing science. The second book, Medicine Maker, is about my recovery, how I went back to my life as an academic, and how I got reinvolved in my own academic work in Africa. And it's also about how my future self and myself, because I believe that this man who lives in the future is a descendant self, that we're both sourced by the same oversoul, the same higher self, or what the Hawaiians call Oumakua. The second book is about how he and I both became medicine makers, medicine men, if you will. And the third book is about training. The third book, Vision Seeker, is about his training in the Kahuna tradition in his time and my training in the shamanic tradition in my time. And it sort of brings all the strings together. As you know, there's also this wonderful relationship he develops with this woman who lives in Western Nevada, and what is today Western Nevada. Everybody wants to know what happens to that one. She's really quite something. But, for those who haven't read this extraordinary trilogy, I encourage you to read it. I myself read it, reread it for the first time just within the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, because I hadn't read it since I turned it over to the publishing house. Once you create these things, they have a life of their own. But, my life has continued to develop in the most interesting way. And I managed to travel around. In a week, I'll be at the Omega Institute near New York. I'll be at the Esalen Institute on the Big Sur coast in August. I'll be in Montana in August as well. And I'll be in Northern Oregon in July, August. So I've got a very full summer ahead of me in terms of
Yes,
teaching.
you're a wonderfully busy man, and I'm so thankful that you had this time available today, because I think it's really important that people read your books, those the trilogy, and then the new one that you have, the newest one, the light, the Bowl of Light, which I just finished reading, and I hope you know how blessed you are that the Hawaiian elder Hale Makua gave you this great gift of wisdom. It's an awesome responsibility, and I would advise everyone to get this book because it gives an overview of life as told by indigenous tribal people all over the world. Very similar things. In Mongolia, they talk about three souls also. But this book gives you an awareness of how everything is alive and part of this huge fabric of life that is has a design and a purpose, and that it's all flowing in a way that is beyond our concept sometimes. We're not able to grasp this whole big vision, but it's a wonderful book. And I'm curious, did he pass on this information to other, like younger Hawaiians who are carrying on the lineage that of what he taught?
Oh yes, you know, he had students. He had students back in the 80s and in the 90s, and he was the
Oh,
council
wonderful.
elder for the Spiritual Warrior Society, the Nga Koa, here in Hawaii. He was the council elder. He was the Kohanunui. You know, for those who've just tuned in, this man Halima Koa was quite exceptional because he was a seventh generation direct descendant of King Kamehameha on his mother's side, and a descendant of High Chief Keawe on his father's side, which meant that, you know, in Polynesia, where genealogy is everything, there were very few individuals at his level. And everyone in Polynesia knew him. I mean, he was kind of like the Dalai Lama of Polynesia. When he would get off the plane in Tahiti, he'd be mobbed at the airport by people who wanted to see him, like the Dalai Lama is mobbed by people who want to see him. And so this man was drawn into connection with me because of my book, Spirit Walker. Back in 1996, Jill and I were invited to an institute here on the Big Island to give a talk. And Makua showed up with a group of these spiritual warriors to look me over. And this was really quite formidable because I knew who he was. I'd been hearing about him for years, but I'd never met him. And he was a very impressive looking person. I mean, he was a head taller than me, and I'm 6 feet tall. He had a great big beard down his chest, a great big white ponytail down his back, a flashy aloha shirt, and he always carried this magnificently carved walking stick, which, you know, essentially carved, it was the record of his story carved into this stick.
His lineage.
So he came to look me over, and on that day, you know, I gave a rather academic talk about the transformational community. That's us. About the beliefs, values, and trends that we hold dear. And at the end of my talk, I began to get this pulling sensation on my soul, as though there was something that he had come to say to me. Now, when you're dealing with indigenous elders, as you know, protocol is everything. You've got to know the
Yes.
protocol, and I didn't know the protocol. So I looked at him and I said, Makua, forgive me, I really don't know what correct protocol is in addressing you, but I'm getting this feeling that there's something that you'd like to say. Would it be correct for me to ask you to speak? And I watched him do something, and I knew what he was doing. I watched him dissociate. He momentarily blanked out. In other words, he glanced into the world of things hidden where his ancestors reside. This is a guy who had like generations of his ancestral spirits following him around as advisors. And then he reappeared about 30 seconds later, and he smiled, and he stood up. Now, there was silence in the room. There must have been 50 people who had come to hear what I had to say. And this was kind of like the high noon moment in Polynesia. This was the moment of truth. So he looked at me across the room, and he smiled and said, a friend of mine sent me your book, Spirit Walker, and I read it. Silence in the room. He said, I read it again just to make sure I got it right. And then I went down to the beach and I took your book and I put it down on the sand and I called in the ancestors and we had a talk about you. Now he looked at me and he said, the ancestors asked me what your name is. And so I told him that your name is Wesselman, Hank Wesselman. And he smiled and said, ancestors told me I wasn't pronouncing your name right. They told me that your name is really Vesselman, that you're a vessel like the canoe. And he's watching me to see if I'm getting it yet. And I'm slowly going into shock because I've been halfway preparing myself to be condemned. You mentioned Serge King earlier with his Huna stuff. You know, the Hawaiians really don't like Hula and they really don't like him. You know, I don't want to say anything negative on the radio about this, but the Hawaiians do not consider Huna as a Hawaiian tradition. They consider it as an outsider's version, which was sort of made up in response to you know, the fact that there are lots of new spiritual traditions coming into being at this time. So Makua's watching me, and I didn't know it, but he was psychic, and he's reading me the whole time I'm thinking. And he laughs, and he says, "Listen, relax. We Hawaiians don't write. We talk, and we share what we find in our hearts with each other. But in your tradition, it's your tradition to write books. And so I've been told to say to you by the ancestors in front of these people here that you are one of the light carriers of aloha. And our job as Hawaiians is to support you because you're making our job easier." This was the beginning of this most interesting friendship that extended over the last 8 years of his life. And we would get together from time to time, sometimes 3 or 4 or 5 times a year. Sometimes we'd spend a few hours together. Sometimes Jill and I would actually go and stay with him. And he would take us to places and show us things and tell us the stories about them. And we would have these extraordinary philosophical discussions. And this is really the content of the Bowl of Light, these incredible talks that he gave and that I was able to bring back after his death. This is really a look into the deep knowledge of the Kahuna mystics. This is not a book about Huna. This is a book about the real thing. And so this is why this book is kind of like a treasure. And part of the reason I wrote it was because I got this incredible urge after this man was killed in a car accident. I got this urge to write something about my friendship with this incredible man. And, you know, it would be like I would get this credit card swipe through my mind, and suddenly Makua's energy was connected with mine. He was on the other side of the mirror. And we would start to have these conversations in my mind, very much like the conversations we had in life. So, you know, although I would never claim that The Bowl of Light is a channeled book, in fact, Makua and I really wrote that book together. It would not be inaccurate to say that. So I hope it has a broad reading response in the mystical movement, which has taken form in the Western world. And I also hope it has a broad response among the young Hawaiians who are seeking to reinvent themselves as Hawaiians in a time of unprecedented change. The older Hawaiians probably won't read this book because, as most of you who are listening are aware, virtually all Hawaiians today are psychologically Christian, and they're not interested in the kahuna wisdom of their ancestors. Of course, there are
What a shame.
exceptions to this. There are exceptions to this. There are families who still hold bits and pieces of the old knowledge, which they guard very, very carefully because it's kind of like cultural treasure. But Makua was really in a league of his own, and he was a publicly speaking and practicing kahuna who was willing to share his knowledge with anybody who wanted to listen. And of course, this is the way old medicine men always worked. They knew that the knowledge was for everyone, not just for one cultural group or order or family. You know, that the time of separation is over and that the time of connection is really taking place in this new cycle of ages, which is coming into being now. Listen, you've noticed that it's not too difficult for me to talk once I get started, I think. So, well, I'm an academic, but I'm a university lecturer. So, you know, anytime you
I
want to
know.
jump in, yeah.
Okay. Well, he was a remarkable man. Did he have children? Does he have a son or someone else that's carrying on his lineage?
He did. He had a military marriage. He was in the Marines for 20 years. He was a sort of a real Rambo type military warrior before he became a spiritual warrior. And he had a military marriage. He had children and grandchildren. It's not really
Oh, wonderful.
my place to talk about his family or
Oh,
his
I know.
relationships.
I know. I could not help but wonder if his lineage was being carried on because it's so important. I mean, he traced his lineage back thousands and thousands, maybe millions of years. And that's pretty amazing.
Well, on the last night of
So,
his life, he told me, as you know, that he was preparing to write down his genealogy. And this, of course, was an incredible thing for him to say. And I said, "Well, how many generations are there going to be?" And he looked at me and he said, "1,260."
Oh my
Now,
goodness.
if you measure out 1,260 by roughly 20 years per generation, it comes out to 25,200 years. And I told him this, and he laughed and said, "Actually, it's closer to 26,000."
You
You
Wow.
see, he was aware of all of the stories of human migrations across the earth. I mean, he had all of that knowledge inside him. And then the following day, he was killed in the car accident, and he took all of that knowledge with him back into the company of his ancestors.
Oh. What about he had written down a lot of that stuff. He showed you a box full of notepads that he had written it on. Did that get passed on to his family, or is that
Well,
available anywhere?
that's a very interesting story. Because I'm a writer, there was a small group of people who were determined that those papers not come into my care. And he, as you know from reading The Bowl of Light, he asked me to take them into my care. And so over a 7-year period, there was a lot of push and pull, tug and shove. But eventually those papers did come to me. And it happened in a very interesting way. The Hawaiian spiritual warrior, who was his student, who had them in his care at that time, called my wife Jill and said, "If you want Makua's papers, I'm going to be at the place of refuge on Sunday." And so Jill was the one. I was in Oregon teaching. Jill was the one who received these papers into our care. And the very next day, the early copy of The Bowl of Light arrived in the mail from my publisher. So The Bowl of Light was written entirely without ever having seen his written notes on his teachings and his channeled information that he got from his ancestors. But it was his desire that I would commit these writings to memory. And so there are about 35 pads of paper, 50 pages each, handwritten notes. And I have penetrated over the last 2 years about 24 of them. I've still got about 10 or 11 to go. And it was his hope that I could incorporate this information into my own memory bank so that when I have these involuntary and very sporadic contacts with this man who lives in the future, that the entire file could be sort of dragged and dropped into this man's mind. It puts me in a very interesting position of being responsible for the transmission of this knowledge across time
Well,
into a
it's very
future slice
important.
of time. Yeah, it sounds pretty flaky, doesn't it? I mean, for a mainstream
No, not
scientist
at
to say
all.
something like that.
Not at all. We thank heavens we are able to go forward and backward in time and heal things that have passed and affect things in the future. So it's a blessing to have that. And he came from an oral tradition. Most of the tribal people, it was an oral tradition to pass on all of their wisdom. And it was required that the people that it was passed on to memorize it verbatim without injecting any of their own thoughts or changing it in any way. And I believe that's because there are so many levels of understanding in those teachings. And of course, if we try to interpret it at our level of understanding, we may lose some of those levels for other people. So it's an awesome responsibility that you have to be able to transmit all of that exactly as it was given to you. And I send you blessings and love to be able to accomplish that purpose.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Tell me a little bit about the three souls. He said that we each have three souls.
Well, from the kahuna perspective, each one of us is a product of the interaction of three entirely separate souls: a body soul, which is the soul of the physical body; a mental soul, which is created in each lifetime in response to life as we live it, which Freud called the ego and Jung called the conscious mind; and then the spirit soul, from which each one of us is sourced into life at the beginning of each life and to which we withdraw at the end of life. You know, in the reincarnational cycle, from the kahuna perspective, each one of us is sourced by an overself, an oversoul, a higher self, which exists always in the spirit world, which dreams. It's the dreamer. And we're dreamed into existence when this self divides and it sends in a portion of its light It's what the meaning of the bowl of light is. That bowl of light is what we receive when we emerge from our mother's body and draw our first breath. Because the breath, what the Hawaiians call the ha, H-A, this is the method of transmission of spirit into
Yes,
matter. And this is
absolutely.
very much in alignment with Judaism and Christianity and even Islam. They all agree that God breathes life into form. But in the mystical tradition of the indigenous people, it's not some fatherly mono god like Zeus who lives off planet and works in mysterious ways. It's our own higher self who breathes life into us, our higher self being our evolving God self. Now, the first thing that this incoming soul seed discovers when it takes up residence within us, that there's another soul already in residence. And that soul is sourced to us from our mother and our father. In the same way that the sex cells, the gametes, the sperm and the egg carry a genetic template from the mother and the father, they also carry a psychic energetic template from the mother and the father, which includes all ancestral imprints, by the way. And this is the energy body within and around which the physical body takes form while in the mother's body. Then, when we're actually born, that energy body is joined by the spiritual source from the upper world, from the higher self, which comes into alignment with it, establishes relationship with it. And then, as we proceed with our life and we grow, increase, and become more, the third soul, the mental soul, takes form in response to our experiences of life. The mental soul is the aspect of ourself that thinks, analyzes, integrates information, practices discernment, makes decisions. It's kind of like our inner chief, our inner CEO that steers us successfully or unsuccessfully through life according to the beliefs that it believes to be so. The body soul is the source of our emotions and feelings. It's also where that inner doorway is to the spirit world. It's the interface between ourself and the other, between the outer world and the inner world. And it's also where that inner healer is, which uses the genetic blueprint and the energetic blueprint in making repairs to the physical body. It's a very interesting study, and this is, you know, these three souls are explored in some depth in the book, The Bowl of Light. Now, that bowl of light that sits within us from our higher self, this is the light that nourishes us and sustains us as we live our life. And it serves as kind of like an open microphone to our higher self, in the sense that the higher self functions by providing us with that faculty that we call intuition or inspiration. And it communicates with us by sending us dreams and visions and hunches and ideas and slips from the tongue, you know, which occur suddenly in response to our need to know something. So these three souls, the spirit soul, the mental soul, and the physical soul, come together to create what we call the self in each life. And although some esoteric traditions like Buddhism claim that the self is an illusion, in my opinion, that's a very interesting theory. Unfortunately, it's wrong. It's an
It's a
error.
theory.
Well,
And theories don't.
I don't think the Buddha students understood what he was saying when he was talking about that. In fact, there are two selves. There is our physically manifested self here and our spiritually manifested self there in the world of things hidden. So there are always two selves. It's a kind of co-creative relationship in which spirit grows, increases, and becomes more in response to what we do and become here on the physical plane. And interestingly, as you've pointed out, this knowledge was widely held among the indigenous people. I mean, the Inuit people, the Eskimo people, understood that we have three souls. The Lakota, three souls. The Cherokee, three souls. The Voodoo
And
people
the
of the
Mongolians
Caribbean.
and the Siberians, yes.
The
Yes.
Siberians, the
Many.
Mongolians, three souls.
Right. That's
This has been
it,
largely
yes.
lost, of course, because of the invasive influence of Christian missionary activity, which, in my
Yes.
opinion, has been a terrible source of cultural imperialism. All, of course, in the name of Jesus, who would have disagreed entirely with the whole purpose of
Yes.
missionization. But that's
Yes,
just
he
my
would.
feeling.
No, it's actually the truth. And because actually there's a book out that I was able to work with a person who is the reincarnated soul of Simon Peter. And he tells a very different story than what the New Testament tells. But in it, it's called Simon Peter's True Testament. And he says that Jesus said that we each contain an inner blueprint, just as an oak tree contains an inner blueprint, or an acorn contains an inner blueprint of an oak tree. We contain an inner blueprint of a great light being. That is who we are, and that we are learning our lessons and growing in the light. And as we eventually grow into the fullness of who we are, we ascend into the worlds of light. But we each, one of us, have that blueprint in us, and that knowledge has been hidden from the world. If people knew that they were God beings, that they were light beings in training, baby ones that are growing into the light, it would be a different world entirely. So, very, very similar to what Makua was teaching you about who we are and what we are.
Well, this knowledge is now reemerging in our own time in response to need. You know, our mainstream religions are really no longer serving us. They are like the old story, and that old story started to be written down 3,000 years ago, and it was based on a very limited worldview and understanding of the universe and our place within it. In our own time, there's a new spiritual complex coming into being. And it's what I summarized in that chapter in the book I wrote with Sandra Ingerman. There's a chapter called The Transformational Community, in which it's really a working foundation for the new spiritual complex,
Okay,
which
Hank,
is
we
going.
are,
Yes?
I'm sorry, we are running out of time, and I do have to end this right now. My engineer is sending me messages. So
Okay.
it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much. I hope you'll join us again sometime in the future.
Lots to
And
talk about.
okay, thank you so much. And to my listeners, join us again next week for some new and exciting information about shamanism and how it will work in your life. Until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.